Wallace and then subsequently tried to blackmail her when her romance with Edward VIII went public. Given the fact that during her Lotus Year, Wallace made little or no effort to meet any Chinese people, men or women, and exhibited a distinct lack of interest in Chinese customs, conversation, or culture, this tale seems unlikely. For the most part, her male friends were American, notably Jerry Green, Colonel Lewis Little, and her train companion, businessman Eddie Miles. When she added up her various beaux, she reckoned that half a dozen men paid court during her stay. For all the excited and often implausible chatter about her many lovers, her abortion, and her training in exotic sexual techniques, what is true is that during her stay in China, Wallace met the most significant man in her life. As in all the best romances, their eyes met across a crowded room. Or rather, she saw her old friend Catherine Moore Bigelow from her days at Coronado as she was dancing with her partner Jerry Green in the ballroom of the Grand Hotel de Pekin, where Wallace had been staying for the previous 3 months. "We recognized each other instantaneously. In that telegraphic manner peculiar to women, we succeeded in communicating to each other, in the instant of mutual rediscovery, the essential facts about each other, that Wynne and I were separated and that she had remarried. A moment later, her husband, Herman Rogers, came up, an unusually attractive man, with a lean, handsome face, brown, wavy hair, and the bearing and look of an athlete." Which, indeed, he was. Herman was a keen swimmer and diver, an excellent polo player, and also an outstanding oarsman who in 1919 captained the American Army rowing team in the Inter-Allied Games in Paris and at the Henley Royal Regatta. By birth, bearing, and behavior, he was to all intents and purposes an American aristocrat, a cultured and cultivated man who pursued beauty and spiritual enlightenment as vigorously as he played polo. He was 5 years older than Wallace, and his father, Archibald, was a wealthy railroad director who owned a mansion, Crumwald, on the Hudson River in Dutchess County, New York. Their immediate neighbors were the Roosevelt family. Sarah Delano Roosevelt was Herman's godmother, and Franklin Delano Roosevelt, a childhood playmate and school friend of Herman's older brother Edmund. He attended Groton School and then Yale, graduating in 1914 as a member of Phi Beta Kappa. During his time there, he was tapped to join the Skull and Bones Secret Society, the nesting place for future politicians, judges, diplomats, and media barons. He briefly studied civil engineering at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology before signing up for service when America entered the war in April 1917. Commissioned as a captain, he was promoted to major and commanded the 2nd Battalion, 10th Field Artillery, seeing action on the Meuse-Argonne line in France. It was while he was on his way to the front on board a troop train that he first set eyes on his future wife. At that time, Catherine, the daughter of a doctor from Colorado Springs, was working as a Red Cross nurse, doling out coffee and cookies to soldiers on the platform of Amiens railway station in northern France. He was smitten by the sight of the tall blonde with an easy grin and dimples to match. "That's the girl I am going to marry if I survive the war," he told a fellow officer. At the time, though, she was married to Ernest Bigelow, the son of a commercial lawyer. It was a curious union, the couple marrying in January 1916, and then 6 months later, Catherine, her sister Constance, and her mother Alma sailing to Paris, where her stepfather, Commander William Randall Sales, had been appointed naval attaché to the American Embassy. She and her sister promptly enrolled in the Red Cross, and Catherine never saw unhappy Ernest, who died of tuberculosis in May 1919, ever again. Fate was indeed taking a hand in shaping the future of the newly widowed Catherine. In the summer of 1920, she was invited to a cocktail party in Manhattan, which was also attended by Herman, now the manager of a New York engineering company. They got to talking, and during their conversation, she brightly identified herself as the nurse whom he had vowed to marry one day. It did not take long for Herman to pop the question. Their engagement was announced on September 14, 1920, followed 10 weeks later by their wedding at the chapel of St. Bartholomew's Church in New York on November 27. They traveled to Honolulu in Hawaii for a lengthy honeymoon. Once married, Herman gave up tinkering with civil engineering, he and Catherine packing their bags to explore the world. First, they stayed in Florence before traveling to the East. "I don't know who they are, but they are very good-looking and attractive," Constance Coolidge wrote to her grandmother when they first arrived. They eventually met and, as with Wallace, became the fastest of friends. During their early days in Peking, Herman believed that their globetrotting experiences could be distilled into the great American novel or a work of philosophy. These literary ambitions remained unfulfilled, though he did write a detective story set in New York, which has yet to be published. When Wallace met them in Peking, they were enjoying their second visit to the capital, the couple living in a house in Tartar City near the Hottoman Gate, one of the many gates in the city. They had carved out a very civilized, aesthetic life, taking daily lessons in Mandarin from their teacher, the goatee-bearded Mr. Wu Wen Ming, reading out loud from an improving work or practicing the techniques of Herman's newfangled toy, a cine camera. Then, of course, there were the games of poker, polo, and swimming to break up the many and varied intellectual pursuits Herman dabbled in. After the Rogerses had further sized up Wallace over luncheon, somewhat impulsively, Catherine asked her to join them as their house guest. At first, she politely refused, but after 3 months of living in a small hotel room and with the prospect of servants and space, she was soon persuaded. Given Wallace's penchant for flirting with other men and taking what was someone else's, Catherine's invitation was rather brave and potentially risky. As Wallace's biographer Charles Murphy observed, after all, he, Herman, was exactly the kind of man for whom her Baltimore breeding had prepared her. Patrician, well-to-do, handsome, cultivated, generous, and at ease in whatever milieu chance placed him. Wallace always said that it was more difficult being an entertaining guest than a host, but during her 6-month stay she proved herself an amiable and amusing companion and friend. For her it was the most delightful, the most carefree, and the most lyric interval of my youth. Their lives were a study in genteel idleness and self-indulgence. As Wallace admitted, the life I led was one of complete uselessness. Every morning before breakfast, the trio went horseback riding on the Glacis, an esplanade surrounding the legation. After a leisurely breakfast, they often swam in the American Legation pool, played tennis, watched polo, or went sightseeing. Wallace loved to shop, and she and Catherine would go to the various artificer streets, such as Silver Street, Flower Street, Furniture Street, Jade Street, and others, where Wallace would have clothes made to measure or add to her growing collection of jade. A favorite store was the Clock Shop, which did not sell clocks, but was where she bought silks, linens, and other materials, often borrowing dresses and other clothes from newly arrived visitors so that their up-to-date style could be copied. She also loved to wander through the traveling weekly fairs. On one occasion, she was thrilled to buy a coral necklace for 30 cents, bartering the stallholder down from his opening price of $30. When she arrived home, she discovered that the coral was red-painted dough and the thread made from human hair. Undaunted, when the trio went to an amateur camel race, Wallace was so enamored by these bad-tempered but hardy creatures that she wanted to buy one and race it herself. For the first few weeks, out of politeness, Wallace joined her hosts at their Chinese lessons, but soon dropped out. "Wallace would come, but wouldn't stick at it, as she never does with anything," noted Herman, who realized that for all her bright banter and beguiling personality, she was a lazy woman, never truly wanting to test herself, happy to remain within her own comfort zone. She was as impatient with Chinese language and culture as she had been with golf when Wynne had tried to teach her. While they worked on their language skills, she would take a deserved afternoon nap before dressing for dinner. Then her rickshaw boy would transport her to the home of friends, parties at the various legations, or for dinner at a Chinese restaurant. Or the trio would stay at home and entertain, usually rounding the evening off with a card game. Jerry Green was a regular visitor, as too was the Belgian ambassador, who had reason to regret his first encounter with Wallace. In a late-night poker game, he lost $225, the equivalent of Wynne's monthly allowance. At weekends, the threesome and a gaggle of friends traveled to the Black Dragon Temple in the Western Hills, which Herman rented. There they enjoyed cooking in the open air, meditating, and exploring the many deserted temples and other religious ruins. As part of this sybaritic lifestyle, Wallace was a very welcome addition to the household, witty, amusing, and gay. Her personality perhaps reminded Catherine, who was friendly yet somewhat reticent, of her young sister Constance, a bubbly extrovert who harbored ambitions to go on the stage. Her mother Alma, who joined them for an extended stay in early 1925, may have agreed. Whereas Catherine was very ladylike and quiet, Wally would play the fool, dressing in a kimono and adopting the pose of popular American comedian Fanny Bryce for Herman's camera, or chatting gaily into the lens when she returned from a polo match. Wallace was a character. No doubt about that. Complex, contradictory, and coquettish. The world's biggest tease, was Herman's settled judgment, whose saucy, knowing wisecracks left many a beau wanting more. Chase me, I'll run slowly, was a familiar phrase, as was, you come too close, you go too far. By degrees, Wallace subtly altered the marital dynamic between Herman and Catherine. This was not a sexual ménage à trois. None of the threesome were especially sexual animals. More of an exchange of power. When Wallace arrived at their home, she was virtually penniless and was dependent on their largesse, Catherine taking her on shopping trips to have clothes made or altered. By the end of her stay, Wallace was sending Herman off to buy her stockings and underwear. It was an exercise in control. As Felipe Espiel had discovered, Wallace was a dominating and dominant personality with a temper to match. She could make me do anything, Herman later admitted, somewhat ruefully. Perhaps his attraction to strong women lay in his family background. His older brothers were, like Herman, quiet, civilized, and reticent. His sisters were formidable characters, strong-willed and authoritative. Even though Herman's sister Nellie Schley was confined to a wheelchair, she was still able to run a 1,000-acre New Jersey farm, barking out orders to the men from the veranda of her house. Wallace managed to get under Herman's skin in a way that this quiet, serious-minded man found surprising. She added the spice to Catherine's steady, dependable character. For all her faults, he found himself somewhat enamored, their relationship that of the teacher and his precocious student, or brother and rambunctious younger sister. At sunset, Herman and Wallace would walk together along the parapet wall overlooking the city, perhaps watching a camel train hastening to enter the city before dusk. During their walks, Herman tried to educate his pupil, pointing out features of historic interest. As far as Wallace was concerned, Herman was accessible but unobtainable. She recognized that the couple lived by the highest ideals and that they were very happy together. Too bad. In Herman, she had found her ideal man. She carefully alluded to the sexual tension between them in her memoir, her autobiography notable for what she doesn't say and for obscuring the truth of her life. Wallace described how Herman would often read to the two women in his life, one book in particular posing a moral dilemma that the threesome thoughtfully discussed. The quandary, as Wallace described it, was whether a wife who had been momentarily and bewilderingly unfaithful should tell her husband of her slip from grace. Catherine and Herman prided themselves on being modern and sophisticated. They held that relations between the sexes should be based on forthrightness and candor, that the old conventions had become hopelessly outmoded, and that any intelligent relationship must take into account the human drives and foibles. Given that, at the time, it was gossiped abroad that they were involved in a curious ménage à trois, it is as if she is trying to tell us something, confessing obliquely to an affair with Herman. As with her visit to the Sing-Song house, she had no need to raise the questions posed by a long-forgotten novel. Herman himself asserted that Wallace much preferred to talk about sex than perform the act. It never occurred to him that Wallace may have fallen in love with him, observed Charles Murphy. This idyllic lifestyle was rudely shattered on May 30, 1925, when Shanghai police, who were led by British officers, fired on a peaceful pro-nationalist march, killing and wounding dozens of demonstrators. What became known as the Nanjing Road Incident in turn inspired the May 30th movement, an anti-imperialist, pro-nationalist uprising that made life very uncomfortable for the expat community throughout China, including Peking. Many Chinese servants walked out on their overseas masters. Chinese shopkeepers refused to cater for foreigners, especially the British, while gangs of students and others roamed the streets harassing and beating the hated Lao Wai. The American ambassador tasked First Secretary Green with the role of leading a fact-finding mission on behalf of American interests to investigate the causes underlying the bloody incident. He and his fellow diplomats spent time in Shanghai, his subsequent report earning him high commendation for its intelligence and thoroughness. It marked the end of any dalliance he enjoyed with Wallace, and 4 years later, in 1929, Green returned to his Boston family roots, marrying a sharp-tongued Back Bay girl, Ruth Fair. He left the diplomatic service in 1935 before trying stockbroking with mixed success. The unrest throughout the country matched the tumult in Wallace's heart. She had been away from America for a year, had had a marvelous few months in Peking and Shanghai, but was no nearer making sense of her future and no closer to divorcing Wynne. With 1,000 kisses and promises to see each other soon, Wallace said goodbye to Herman and Catherine in early September 1925. Not realizing until she had gone how much she would miss them, particularly Herman. His was a friendship that would endure. In her coy way, she observed, "From my experience with Herman Rogers alone, there is truth in the saying that friends made in China always remain friends." With fewer regrets, she also left behind her Tibetan terrier, Gaga, in the care of the Rogerses, before heading to Japan on the first leg of her journey back to Washington. Typically, the incorrigible Mrs. Spencer disembarked in Yokohama, Japan, because of a man, or rather, men. "I had a beau," she recalled. She took a train to Tokyo, where she was reunited with her male friend, whose name is lost in the mists of address books. "We went sightseeing. In fact, there were two or three men I knew there. That's why I stopped off." As she sailed on to the United States on board the President McKinley, she became seriously ill with an internal ailment, which left the shipboard doctor puzzled and Wallace needing an operation when the ship docked in Seattle. This mystery operation has often been connected with her ambiguous gynecological condition. She was well enough to travel east from Seattle, Wynne waiting for her in Chicago, where he took her to see his family in Highland Park. Wallace spent a few days there recuperating. Then Wynne, sober and courteous, accompanied his wife on the final leg of her journey to her mother's apartment in Washington. It was the last act of a man of simple needs and standards who, try as he might, loved the bottle rather more than he ever loved his wife. She arrived back in Washington to discover that her mother had at last found happiness at the third attempt. She was going to marry a distinguished-looking widower, Charles Gordon Allen, who had a son named Bounce and his own home. With characteristic wit, her mother announced that she was firmly on her last lap. As for Wallace, now in her 30th year, she had yet to begin the race. Chapter 5. Wallace Stole My Man. Wallace's wandering days were over, at least for the time being. After sailing around the globe in the vain search for a divorce, the Baltimore girl discovered to her astonishment that she could obtain one in the neighboring state of Virginia, ancestral home to the Montague side of her family, for the princely sum of $300. Naturally, though, there were hoops to jump through. She had to produce a letter from Wynne stating that he no longer wished to live with her, be separated from him for 3 years, and live in Virginia for 2 years. In order to fast-track the proceedings so that she would be free by late 1927, Wynne would have to backdate his letter of separation. He went along with the scheme, which was clearly collusive, dating his letter to June 1924 when he was first assigned to the Far East. His letter ticked all the relevant boxes. "I have come to the definite conclusion that I can never live with you again. During the past 2 years since I have been away from you, I have been happier than ever before. Please be kind enough not to annoy me with any more letters. Yours, Wynne." That settled. She now had to establish residency, choosing to stay in the Warren Green Hotel in the leafy town of Warrenton, just 24 miles from her cousin Corrine at Wakefield Manor and a short train journey to Washington. Before moving into her new abode, she visited her mother to pack up her belongings. Her mother was now finally reconciled to Wallace proceeding with her divorce. "If you and Wynne can't get on, there's no sense in your trying to pretend that you can," she commented. Not that she was especially keen on her daughter spending a year living alone in a country hotel. She offered to travel with her and spend a few days helping to get her settled. Wallace declined, saying, "Nothing could possibly happen to me in Warrenton. From what I hear about the Warren Green Hotel, it would be a proper place for a bishop's daughter." Her mother, who usually had the last word, replied, "Perhaps so, but you are no bishop's daughter." "I shall conduct myself as if I were one," Wallace said. "Besides, like Moses, I am going into the wilderness to reflect." She was certainly traveling to a social wilderness, swapping the bright lights of Paris and the delights of Peking, the dinners, the dances, and the beaux, for room number 212, a miserly 15-by-12-foot chamber and a shared bathroom. Her temporary home was decorated with faded flowered wallpaper, a high brass bed, battered night table, imitation mahogany bureau, a classic example of what my mother used to call inferior decorating. Hardly the suite of rooms and servants she enjoyed with the Rogerses. The days of chatting with ambassadors, antiquarians, and military attachés were now distant memories. Instead, she was on nodding acquaintance over breakfast with harassed men carrying attaché cases, traveling salesmen who formed the bulk of the hotel's weekly trade. As she recalled, "For a woman seeking a divorce, the price also included the prospect of being voluntarily buried alive for 2 years." She did, though, make new friends and renew acquaintances, her circle including former school friends from Arundel and Oldfields, a one-time crush called Lloyd Tabb, her first boyfriend from the Burland summer camp, fashion designer Jane Derby, and, remarkably, Dr. Miles Lewis Allen, the physician who delivered her. "On the whole, my first year at Warrenton was the most tranquil I have ever known," recalled the party girl, who had spent her 20s obeying the rallying cry of poet Edna St. Vincent Millay and had burned the candle at both ends. "I simply rusticated, and when I wasn't rusticating, I vegetated with equal satisfaction." Short of transport, she was taken in tow by an old beau, Hugh Spillman, who squired her around in his old three-pedal rattling flivver. Then working as a lowly $125-a-week teller at the Faucure National Bank, he introduced her to the horsey set, played golf with her on a nine-hole course, and played poker late into the night. She was, he duly reported, a bad-tempered loser. Young Stillman, though, was besotted. "I was pretty crazy about her, even though she was an awful little flirt," he recalled. Of course, Stillman was simply not in her league, so when he finally screwed up the courage to ask her to marry him, her refusal reflected realism rather than romance. "You're poor, I'm poor, and we both need money," she told him. Later, she told her friends that she would have married Hugh if he knew how to read anything besides the daily racing form. While Spillman was devoted to racing guides, the intellectual runners and riders in Wallace's world, so she claimed, were novels by F. Scott Fitzgerald, Sinclair Lewis, Somerset Maugham, and Ford Madox Ford. For someone who boasted that she never read a book, Wallace was also, according to her account, busily declaiming poetry and wrestling with the history of philosophy. One book particularly captured her attention. Unusually for her, Wallace read it from beginning to end. This was The Passing of the Great Race, a bestseller written by lawyer and eugenicist Madison Grant, who argued for scientific racism, asserting the superiority of the Nordic, or what the Nazis would call the Aryan race. Jews, the Chinese, people of color, Roman Catholics, even the French, all failed the eugenic test of racial superiority. As part of his overarching argument, Grant supported the sterilization of undesirables and worthless race types in order to reinvigorate the dominant Nordic ethnic group. Such was the impact of Grant's thinking on the then-unknown German political rabble-rouser Adolf Hitler, that he wrote to the author saying that his book had become his Bible. Like thousands of her fellow white Protestant Americans, Wallace subscribed to Grant's thesis. She was from a class, an age, and a region where, quite unselfconsciously, Wallace and her friends, including Mary Kirk, were nonchalantly racist. Unsurprising, given that her family were one-time slave owners who considered the local black population to be at the bottom of the social pyramid, unworthy of the franchise. In letters and table talk, she casually referred to people of color as niggers, coons, or darkies. Indeed, it was not until the Second World War, when Wallace was based in the Bahamas, that she first shook the hand of a person of color. In correspondence, Wallace and her friends would refer to someone as a Jew in a way that was not so much personally disdainful as indicating their place in the social pecking order as someone not of the first rank. On one occasion, for instance, she wrote to her Aunt Bessie describing how her friend, diplomat Martin Mike Scanlon, had married a woman who could not bring herself to marry the rich Jew, and so had accepted Scanlon's offer instead. During the 1920s, what was known as polite discrimination towards Jewish people was a growing feature of American life. At that time, Jews were barred from numerous social clubs and societies, such as golf clubs and the Freemasons, discriminated against in employment, particularly for white-collar jobs, prevented from visiting some resorts, and subject to a quota system at Ivy League and other colleges. Like others of her class, Wallace's automatic social reflex was anti-Semitic, a mindset that played an important part in the next phase of her life. From time to time, Wallace left her books, newspapers, and magazines behind and traveled to Washington to see her mother or to New York to stay with Mary Kirk and her husband, Jacques Raffray, at their charming apartment in Washington Square. Like many of Wallace's girlfriends, Mary was keen to see her friend happy, settled, and married once again. She had visited Wallace in Warrenton and appreciated Wallace's need to get out of Dodge. The matchmaker in her believed that once her divorce was finalized, Wallace should marry again as soon as possible. She was now 30, and the clock was ticking. For her looks, her chance of starting a family, and of achieving financial security. Whenever Wallace arrived to stay, Mary would always ensure that a possible suitor was lined up to be given the once-over. Mary was, as her younger sister Anne remarked, a useful friend. In the winter of 1925, Mary and her husband were guests of Ernest Simpson and his wife Dorothea at the opera. For some reason, Jacques had to drop out. Mary contacted the Simpsons and asked if a friend of hers who had recently returned from China could take his place. Enter Wallace. Her first impressions of her host were of a man who seemed too serious, but upon second glance, she noticed his twinkling blue eyes and mischievous smile. That he was of Jewish descent did not feature in the description of that first fateful encounter in a chain of events that was to rock an empire. That Christmas, the Simpsons were invited to a party at the Raffray's apartment. Wallace was there, too, and clearly made a favorable impression on Dorothea, who later recalled, "She was witty and clever, far cleverer than I. She made any party something special." Wallace and Dorothea, though, were like night and day. Dorothea was diffident, withdrawn, and prone to illness. Wallace hard-boiled and hard-wired for fun. At first, Dorothea didn't see her as a threat, even though Wallace had clearly caught the eye of her husband. Ernest, a year older than Wallace, was always happy to come over to the Raffrays to make up a fourth for an evening of bridge. From time to time, he would partner with Mrs. Spencer, and slowly but surely, the Wallace magic, her ability to mesmerize a man by focusing her burning blue eyes on what they were saying, seemed to be working. In their conversations, she appreciated his wonderful mind, which was playful and good-humored, but he also exhibited a curiosity about the world which she found stimulating and rather sexy. Ernest, who won a poetry prize at school, was always ready to declaim a stanza or two and had the knack of making up rhyming couplets for any social occasion. Well-read and very sure of himself, was the verdict of Claire Booth Brokaw, later Claire Booth Luce, then an editor of Vanity Fair, who attended one of the Raffray's parties. The sly, unstated chemistry that existed between the married man and the eager, unattached woman exploded that Easter of 1926. After attending the traditional Sunday parade, Ernest and a fellow guards officer arrived at the Raffrays, bursting with bonhomie and bright smiles after enjoying the hospitality of various New York hostesses. They were, according to Mary's sister Anne, the souls of amiability and glamour, and they brought the odors of fresh spring flowers with them. Wallace was ready to pick the bloom. Anne continued. There, already with her open arms, was Wallace, with her heart on her sleeve, and seemingly saying to Ernest, "You are a gallant knight on a white charger, coming to rescue me from the wicked world of poverty and oblivion where most of my friends go, never to return to the bright life of fame. I can see her beautiful blue eyes now, and her square hands clawing the air in ecstasy." She certainly had her talons directed at Ernest, a man who was, to all intents and purposes, Herman Rogers Light. Like Herman, he had gone to an Ivy League college, Harvard rather than Yale, was a competent linguist, was interested in foreign cultures, and was widely traveled. During his school summer holidays, his father took him to Britain and continental Europe. Unlike Herman, he had a full-time job, working at his father's shipping company, Simpson, Spence & Young, which had offices in London and New York. His nationality was similarly split. His father, also Ernest, was from a Jewish family, the Solomons, which originated from Warsaw in Poland. Ernest Sr. became a naturalized American citizen shortly after he arrived in New York in 1873. An Anglophile to his fingertips, he was thrilled when his daughter Maud, 20 years older than Ernest Jr., married a prominent British Member of Parliament, Peter Carr Smiley. By contrast, Ernest's mother, Charlotte, the daughter of a well-connected New York lawyer, was hostile to the old world, found the French dishonest and the English dull. If Wallace had the conflicting characteristics of the Montagues and Warfields in her makeup, so Ernest enjoyed, and endured, the push and pull of his joint American and British heritage. In the midst of the First World War, Ernest finally decided where his true loyalties lay. He abandoned his studies at Harvard and sailed for England, believing that it was his patriotic duty to fight for King and the country of his father's birth. He enlisted in the Officer Cadet Battalion of the Household Brigade, and in June 1918 was gazetted second lieutenant in the Coldstream Guards. He remained in training until the armistice, never seeing action. At the end of the war, he decided to become a naturalized British subject, even though he was back in New York and worked for his father. When he walked down Madison Avenue dressed in his pinstriped suit and guard's tie, carrying a rolled umbrella, his mustache neatly trimmed, he had the air of a classic English gentleman heading for his office in the City of London. Like his sister, Ernest had made a good match, in February 1923 marrying lawyer's daughter Dorothea Doty Parsons to Sher. Her great-grandfathers were, respectively, a U.S. Senator and a Chief Justice of the Massachusetts Supreme Court. They lived on the fashionable Upper East Side, where, a year later, Dorothea gave birth to her second daughter, Audrey. She already had one daughter, Cynthia, from her marriage to former Princeton student and sometime businessman, James Flanagan Desher. So while Wallace found Ernest attractive, sensible, and cosmopolitan, he shared another unwelcome characteristic with Herman. An inconvenient wife and, additionally, a highly inconvenient daughter and stepdaughter. The useful Mary assured her friend that though Ernest had not been married long, he was unhappy. She and her sister Anne had taken tea with the fragile, prematurely graying Mrs. Simpson at their Upper East Side apartment, duly reporting to Wallace that she was ill and neurotic. Shortly afterwards, she sailed for France and the American Hospital of Paris, where it seems she had treatment for a nervous condition. Ernest was left behind, lonely and vulnerable. As he and Wallace began seeing one another on a more regular basis, it was not too long before Wallace's mother got wind of developments in New York. It was not hard to imagine her horrified response. An impetuous marriage to a drunken sailor aviator was one thing. The deliberate seduction of another woman's husband who was the father to two young daughters was quite another. She discussed her concerns with her sister Bessie, who had a solution, suggesting Wallace accompany her on a Mediterranean cruise that summer and fall. A change of scene from Warrenton would do her good, and maybe the company on board the cruise would take her mind off her latest enchantment. "Your mother tells me that you think you may be falling in love again," Aunt Bessie asked. They sailed from New York and into the Mediterranean, steaming by the whitewashed villages along the Amalfi coast before landing at Trieste in northeast Italy. From there they motored along the French Riviera and traveled to Paris. As Aunt Bessie predicted, there were several shipboard beaux who took her dancing after dinner and generally paid court to her. They included a Pennsylvanian lawyer and later a tempestuous and gallant Irishman who learned to take no for an answer. Her stay in Paris brought back bitter memories of her past rather than thoughts of her bright future. After dinner one evening in late October 1927, she saw on the front page of the American edition of the Paris Herald Tribune a story about the death of her Uncle Saul. While versions vary, Wallace, upset and scared, hurried back to the Hotel Lottie to tell her aunt. Bessie had herself just received a cable from her sister Alice, Wallace's mother, informing her of Saul's death. Aunt Bessie sighed. "Saul Warfield may not have been the most tolerant man on this earth, but he was good to you, Wallace." Wallace searched her heart for something to say but struggled, reflecting only on his coldness and how he saw her as the black sheep of the family. Even though they sailed for New York as soon as they were able, they missed Uncle Saul's funeral and the reading of the will. It was widely expected that Wallace, whom Saul had legally made his ward, would be left the bulk of his estimated $5 million fortune. Instead, she learned that he had bequeathed his money and his country estate, Manor Glen, to be used as a home for distressed gentlewomen in memory of Anna, his mother, and Wallace's grandmother. For her part, Wallace received the interest every quarter on $15,000 which was held in a trust fund. Even this meager amount, interest rates were around 2% in 1928, ceased upon her remarriage. Wallace learned to her horror that 2 months before his death, Uncle Saul, enraged that Wallace had gone ahead with her divorce against his wishes, had changed his will. Wallace was not just angry about Uncle Saul and his will. She was, according to Mary Raffray, furious. She fumed at the injustice and raged at the hypocrisy of her uncle who, as she had concluded from the many photographs of female singers and actresses in his New York apartment, was not averse to a pretty woman. In her eyes, he had shirked his chance to ensure her financial independence, forcing her continued reliance on men. His niggardly gesture was another example of him tipping her, this time from beyond the grave. After talking it over, she and another relative contested the will, the legal back and forth taking another 3 years to resolve. On appeal, she received a larger payout, approximately $47,500 worth of U.S. stocks. The money not paid until January 1930. By then, the stock market had crashed, and Uncle Saul's stocks were worth a fraction of their previous value. Once again, Montague Luck snatched defeat from the jaws of victory. In the midst of the drama over Uncle Saul's will, Wallace finally got her divorce. On December 6, 1927, just a few days after her return from Paris following her 3-month European trip, her divorce petition was submitted to Fauquier County Circuit Court, where it was heard by Judge George Latham Fletcher. During the various dispositions made by her mother, Wynne, and others, Wallace swore on oath that she had not seen Wynne for 3 years. Their encounters in Hong Kong and more recently in Chicago, where she had stayed with his family for a few days, were conveniently forgotten. The judge may have raised his eyebrows at the inconsistencies, but turned a blind eye, granting a divorce decree on December 10th. "It was just a matter of incompatibility," observed Wallace's lawyer, Aubrey Weaver. There seemed to be no hard feelings, Wynne Spencer coming to the courthouse before the divorce was granted, and chatting with his soon-to-be ex-wife. "Wallace and he shook hands and departed friends," Weaver recalled. She was now free to remarry, the primary candidate for her hand, the pinstriped figure of Ernest Simpson, who had also somewhat conveniently recently secured his own divorce. While Wallace saw herself as a passive observer in this marital drama, Ernest's now ex-wife Dorothea, frail and with little energy, saw things differently. Her early favorable impressions of Wallace had understandably soured, and she accused her now of infiltrating her life while she was ill and snatching her husband away. "Wallace was a very helpful woman. First she helped herself to my apartment, then she helped herself to my clothes, and finally she helped herself to my husband." He was not the only contender for Wallace's hand. With jaunty exaggeration, her Warrenton beau, Hugh Spillman, liked to boast that he proposed to her every day. He claimed that during her stay in Virginia she had had at least 30 different proposals, many from young men who attended the regular parties hosted by her cousins, the Barnetts, in the horsey town of Front Royal. As a gambling man, though, Spillman would have put his money on Ernest Simpson. He was a racing certainty to win the prize. During her visits to New York, he took Wallace to the theater, out dancing, and had shown her the sights. He was down to earth, sensible, sober, and kind, the exact opposite of her first husband. Indeed, when she had first met him, he and Dorothea were part of the temperance movement. Thoughtful, too, Ernest taking at face value Wallace's boast that she had read widely while biding her time in Warrenton, he gave her armfuls of books to read, notably Lytton Strachey's 500-page biography of Queen Victoria. As he would later discover, her real literary diet was fashion magazines leavened with the odd work of light fiction. His choices were indigestible. More palatable was his serious talk of marriage. He had already told her that when they were free, he would like her to be his bride and partner in life. She had hesitated. Having pursued him and wrested him from the arms of another, she now had second thoughts. There was much to consider. Freeing herself from Wynne had taken the best part of a decade, during which time she had led a rootless, somewhat self-indulgent life. She didn't want to make another mistake. Then there was Ernest's ambition to live in London, learning the details of the shipping business away from his father's constant interference. While Ernest loved England and the English, Wallace knew nothing about the country, its customs, or its climate. She would be saying goodbye to her mother, her aunt, the Montagues, and her loyal circle of friends for an uncertain future. Moreover, she would not just be taking on another husband and a new country, but becoming stepmother to a little girl, Ernest's daughter Audrey. Wallace, as a mother, even at one remove, is not an image that readily springs to mind. Then there was the fact that Ernest was part Jewish. While she was never explicit in referring to his ethnicity, in her memoir she made oblique allusions to his race, writing that Ernest had always yearned to follow the ways of his father's people. In a knowing jab, she suggested that Ernest never seemed to be an altogether typical Englishman. Perhaps most significantly, she also nursed the belief, based on her lawyer's advice, that she was odds on to become a wealthy woman. The signs were that the court case involving Uncle Saul's will would go in her favor. The winter of 1928 was a time of uncertainty but also of hope that she could hit the jackpot. If Lady Luck smiled on her, she would never need to rely on men again, stick or twist. She decided to hedge her bets. First, she said yes to his proposal, then no, and finally asked for more time to consider. In the meantime, the newly divorced Ernest sailed for London and a new life. She had only the modest settlement from Wynne to rely on, and Wallace's friends encouraged her to take a job. Her friend from Warrington, Jane Derby, ran a dress shop in New York, and Mary Raffray worked in a fashion store run by a Mrs. John Betts on 57th Street. Ernest's ex-wife, Dorothea, had worked in the same store for a time. When she was in New York, Wallace visited the store every day, invariably going out for lunch with Mary. As shop owner Mrs. Betts recalled, she was always chic. She loved clothes and knew how to wear them with an air. It seemed the commercial world of fashion was calling, but even though she had contacts, she never pursued a career working in an upmarket dress store where her fashion and sales sense would have been put to use. Instead, she dipped her toe into the waters of fashion by entering a writing competition where the prize was an editorial job at Vogue magazine. For a woman who considered writing letters and visiting the dentist to be her two pet hates, it was hardly surprising that her essay on spring hats was rejected. Somewhat curiously, she spent 3 weeks in Pittsburgh with her friends Morgan and Elizabeth Schiller, learning how to be a saleswoman for their tubular steel scaffolding company. Even though Morgan was keen on the prospect of employing a sassy young woman to convince hard-boiled construction engineers about the benefits of his product, Wallace was not convinced. She walked away from his job offer, citing her poor mathematical ability. Now living in a top-floor garret hotel room in a freezing New York winter, her savings diminishing daily and with no work on the horizon, it seemed that her options were rapidly running out. As she pondered marriage to Ernest and life in a strange country, out of the blue she received an invitation from Herman and Catherine Rogers to join them at their new villa, Louvier, in the coastal town of Cannes on the French Riviera. It was to be something of a China reunion, as Constance Coolidge was also joining them. There was an ulterior motive behind her acceptance of their invitation. Ostensibly, she wanted their advice on whether she should remarry so soon. As the Rogerses had never met Ernest Simpson, this seemed an odd proposition. In truth, her hesitation spoke volumes about her feelings for Ernest Simpson. She simply didn't love him the way she had Wynne Spencer in the early days of their marriage, or Felipe Espiel during their torrid affair in Washington. Nor had she felt the easy companionship she did with Herman Rogers. She didn't need to sail more than 3,000 miles to ask a question when the answer lay much closer to home, in her heart. Before committing herself to solid, dependable Ernest, she wanted to see for herself the state of the marital union between the man she would have married in a heartbeat and her friend, Catherine Rogers. She had pried one man away from his wife, why not another? When she arrived in Cannes, she was disappointed to discover that Herman and Catherine were still happy and close, neither of them suffering the 7-year itch. As Herman's stepdaughter-in-law, Catherine Kitty Blair, observes, "Knowing Wallace's personality, when she went to the south of France it was probably to see my stepfather and sound out if he would make a move regarding divorcing Catherine. At the very least, she needed Herman's approval to go ahead with the wedding." It was the arrival of the Queen of Peking herself, Constance Crowninshield Coolidge, that really drove Wallace into the arms of Ernest Simpson. As Constance relayed the story of her disastrous second marriage, Ernest became more and more appealing. Since they had last seen Constance, she had divorced American diplomat Ray Atherton and then, in October 1924, married an impecunious French count, Pierre Chapelle de Jumelac. Though she became Comtesse de Jumelac, the marriage itself was a disaster. The first months, when she was beguiled by this charming cad, enthralled to his physicality and wild ways, were a sexual adventure. He was, she confessed, a most affectionate and exciting lover. As Constance told her diary, "The first years with Pierre were worth a whole life. I was a slave of love, and he passionately loved me." She paid a high price, her husband squandering much of her fortune on buying horses, gambling, and drugs. When he was high on cocaine, he got angry and beat her cruelly, on one occasion bursting her eardrum. By the time the Comtesse de Jumelac blew into Louviers, the bloom was off the rose. Her husband's behavior, particularly his drug use, was now so outlandish that Constance was also actively considering divorce. She finally won her freedom a year later. She may have been a rich adventurer with a healthy appetite for men and sex, but at that time of crisis in her own life, someone like safe, kind, and gentle Ernest may have been very appealing. The same thought occurred to Wallace as she, Herman, and Catherine listened to Constance's lurid account of her failing second marriage and then discussed her own future with the dependable and mature Englishman. Wallace loved men, but not in the same way as the Queen of Peking. Her vision was much more traditional, of a woman as a steady helpmate rather than a wild romantic. "I was a product of my upbringing. A southern girl brought up to believe that a woman's role is to marry, bring refreshment, variety, amusement, and, if possible, love into a man's life." With Constance's experience firmly in mind, Wallace wrote to Ernest in June accepting his offer of marriage. Ernest wrote back at once and said he had already begun making arrangements. "I put all my wistful thoughts behind me," she wrote. "I was happy." She said goodbye to the Rogerses and the Countess on June 23, 1928, only 4 weeks before her wedding day. She took the train to Paris, where she bought a yellow wedding dress with a matching blue coat before catching the Golden Arrow boat train. She arrived in England just 3 days before her wedding, Ernest meeting her at Victoria Station with a brand new yellow Lagonda touring car and a chauffeur called Hughes, who was wearing a uniform of a rather more subdued color. After installing her in a service flat in central London, they headed off to ritzy Bond Street to buy her a wedding ring. Amidst the excitement, her first impressions of London were gray, shapeless, and blurred. "I felt like I was entering a man's club," she recalled. The couple spent the first night alone, catching up on the last few months. On the second, they were joined by Ernest's father, a tiny, dwarf-like figure with piercing eyes and snowy white hair, a caricature description of an elderly Jewish businessman, who left Wallace in no doubt that though he was retired, he kept an iron grip on his shipping company. Before her wedding day, she took the trouble to send a telegram to her Warrenton beau, Hugh Spillman. "Unexpectedly, I find myself marrying Ernest tomorrow. Much love." The wording suggested, as ever, that she was backing reluctantly into the marriage contract. They married on a sunny and warm summer's day at Chelsea Register Office at 11 in the morning of July 21, 1928. While she was taken to the venue by their new chauffeur, the brief ceremony was a far cry from the romantic church service she enjoyed the first time around in Baltimore. She was hurried through gloomy corridors to a tatty room where a bored official gabbled through the requisite legal vows before pronouncing them man and wife. Even Ernest remarked it was a cold little job. After several glasses of good champagne at the sooty Great Western Hotel near Paddington Station, they headed for Paris and a honeymoon visiting the chateaus and vineyards of the Loire Valley and beyond into northern Spain. Wallace was happy, or so she told herself. Chapter 6. This Weird Royal Obsession. It was undoubtedly the worst year of her life. Wallace Simpson hated England and loathed the English. She detested their quaint customs, their ridiculously tiny counties, and their crumbling castles. Especially their crumbling castles, which Ernest loved to visit, spending hours poring over inscriptions on tombstones, inspecting wall hangings and flags, admiring the stone masonry. Newlywed Wallace would sit, shivering in the car, bored, irritated, wondering what on earth she was doing. "I'm sick of seeing old things. I want to see something young," she wailed. She had no time for English people, didn't get to the pitch of their humor, their strange adoration for the monarchy, their militaristic history, their quiet pride for the flag, and their ludicrous love of dogs and horses. They were a continuing mystery. Long before royalty entered her life, she had decided that the English were not worth a dime, or a threepenny bit, or a half-crown, or a 10-bob note, or whatever name these people called their ridiculously complicated currency. Not that she understood more than one word in five. Half the time she had no idea what these odd people with their blank faces and mouthfuls of bad teeth were saying. With all the pointing and gesticulating, she could have been back in Peking. They certainly didn't understand her. And London! What on earth did Ernest see in the place? Drab, gray, depressing like the weather. When it was not cloudy, it was raining, and when it was not raining, it was foggy. Gloomy Mondays, Tuesdays, Wednesdays. Not that she could see the sky from the basement kitchen of her rented house. It was like a prison, dark, tiny, and damp. And then there was her sister-in-law, Maud Carr Smiley. Nothing smiley about a woman 20 years older and light years away in attitude. She was all careful condescension and snooty superiority. "Who on earth does she think she is, telling me what Ernest wants for his supper, calling me every day with her suggestions about where I should buy the meat, the fish, even my underwear?" All that little brother this and little brother that. There developed between us a subtle struggle over who would manage Ernest's life, Wallace tactfully recalled. It was like trying to join a secret society where she didn't know the rules. So hard to know what these people were thinking as they sipped their cups of tea and nibbled their tiny cucumber sandwiches. When she said the word okay, Maud gave her a freezing look. It was as though she had just goosed the Archbishop of Canterbury. So if okay is not okay, what was? She realized that this was not a club she wanted to join. As she later recalled, I began by not liking London at all.